Welcome to this Friday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In today's show, Taylor Charlstrom will bring us information on the nuances of carbon products as part of the larger biological products sphere, as well as their modes of action. And Kylie Harlan reports on a parasitic wasp that controls a highly destructive fruit fly being released after 12 years of research. I'll bring you regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
The first class of the Sonoma County Wine Grape Growers Foundation Leadership Academy for Vineyard Employees has graduated. The first class of graduates is comprised of 15 local vineyard employees, each nominated by their employer. The goal of this first-of-its-kind program is to create future community and business leaders. The Academy class attended 8 half-day sessions and 2 field-day trips, all focused on advancing skills and empowering vineyard employees to seek leadership roles within their organization or in the community. The program goes beyond farming to advance communication skills, financial literacy, and business knowledge. The Leadership Academy will be held annually and will be soon taking nominations for the 2023 class. The United Farm Workers launched a 24-day march to raise awareness about a bill they say will make it easier for California farm workers to vote in union elections and ultimately join collective bargaining contracts. The 335-mile march for the governor's signature started on Wednesday with a 500-person rally at the Farm Worker Union's original headquarters in Delano, known as the 40 Acres. UFW President Teresa Romero, along with 30 to 50 core marchers and other participants, are making their way across the Central Valley towards the state capital, covering an expected 12 to 20 miles a day. The march has stops in the northern San Joaquin Valley each day, now through August 22nd. The march is an effort to raise awareness of the Agricultural Labor Relations Voting Choice Act and to pressure Governor Gavin Newsom to sign AB 2183, which would amend the Agricultural Labor Relations Act to expand voting options for farm workers. Both California and Arizona are experiencing the biggest drought in 1,200 years. The issues and history behind water in America's West would fill a very thick book. The solution is no doubt as complex as a problem, but it seems certain that the solution has to include infrastructure. The two states have taken very different approaches to this issue. At the beginning of July, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed Senate Bill 1740, investing $1.2 billion over 3 years to fund projects that will bring additional water to the state to secure Arizona's water future, improve existing water infrastructure, and implement effective conservation tools, according to the website of the Western Growers Association, which promoted the legislation. The projects will help to ensure that Arizona families, businesses, and agriculture continue to have adequate long-term water supplies. The WGA site goes on to note that the Act gives the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority an additional authority and tools that will empower the state to be proactive in bringing in new water resources. In California, matters seem to be at a stalemate. On July 28th, Max Gomberg resigned his position as Climate Change and Conservation Director for the California State Water Resources Control Board. In a prepared comment criticizing Governor Gavin Newsom's approach, he said to his water board colleagues that witnessing the agency's ability to tackle big challenges nearly exacerbated by this administration has been gut-wrenching. Gomberg also criticized agricultural interests. He says he thinks California needs an agriculture policy. The de facto policy is cheap food as cheap as possible. Don't do anything that would any way impinge on the ability of people growing any kind of agricultural product to grow as much as they want, where they want, with however much water they want. Where Gomberg would like to go is clear, since he advocates quickly and permanently reducing agriculture to manage the loss of water. One area of conflict which has persisted for decades is the amount of water that should be permitted to pass through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to protect environmental interests instead of going to agriculture. Gomberg says that California needs to develop a long-term, consistent, and equitable agricultural policy. The California Department of Food and Agriculture's State Water Efficiency and Enhancement Program provides financial assistance in the form of grants to implement irrigation systems that allow California farmers and ranchers to reduce greenhouse gases and save water. The SWEAT program has invested $123 million over the last 8 years, leading to an estimated water savings of 1.5 million acre feet, or nearly 50 billion gallons. Additionally, nearly 94,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent are reduced each year, which is like removing more than 200,000 vehicles from the road. The California Department of Food and Agriculture's State Water Efficiency and Enhancement Program provides financial assistance in the form of grants to implement irrigation systems that allow California farmers and ranchers to reduce greenhouse gases and save water. The SWEAT program has invested $123 million over the last 8 years, leading to an estimated water savings of 1.5 million acre feet, or nearly 50 billion gallons. Additionally, nearly 94,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent are reduced each year, which is like removing more than 200,000 vehicles from the road.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Taylor Chalstrom joins us on the show now as he brings information on the nuances of carbon products as part of the larger biological product sphere, as well as their modes of action.
As more and more biological products enter the quote-unquote arena of applied agriculture products to plants, it's becoming a lot more difficult to define them. It's easy to just lump biologicals, biostimulants, and carbon products into one category, but the fact is they all have different roles and different definitions. Biostimulants are defined in the 2018 Agriculture Improvement Act as a substance or microorganism that, when applied to seeds, plants, or the rhizosphere, stimulates natural processes to enhance or benefit nutrient uptake, nutrient efficiency, tolerance to abiotic stress, or crop quality and yield. Additionally, all biologicals are biostimulants, but not all biostimulants are biologicals. Hillier's Cassidy Million goes even deeper.
A biological is a biostimulant that can contain a living organism. So this can be things such as your bacillus, pseudomonas, or trichoderma that you can find in your inoculants. So these are living organisms that are delivered as living in their final product form. And while the backbone of most of these biostimulants and biological products are carbon, this newer term, I would say carbon products, has came into play. So carbon products kind of cast a larger net to include other modes of action such as micro and macro algae, biochars, and humic and fulvic acids. So these carbon products usually can be chemical byproducts or formerly living organisms that have been treated by hydrolysate, pasteurization, and so these are usually non-living in their final product form.
That non-living aspect of a carbon product is one of the bigger differences compared to a biological or biostimulant. Because of this, and the fact that it is carbon-based, a carbon product will offer multiple modes of action, a term most are likely familiar with in herbicides and insecticides, different from those of similar products.
One of these would be your microbial food. The second could be your soil enzyme. Then you have a soil inoculant. Your fourth would be your seaweeds and kelp. And then lastly are your humic and fulvic acids. And sometimes biochar kind of gets chunked into that as well. So just a brief description of each one of these is microbial foods are incorporated into soil. And these are, their mode of action is to feed the native soil microbiome. So this is food for those fungi and bacteria that are already present in the soil. So products could be a microalgae, a sugar, a molasses, or a fish preparation could be clumped into these microbial foods. But to note that not all microbial foods are created equally. They don't all contain the same quality or quantity of food. So I like to kind of compare that to us humans going to a restaurant. So we go into a restaurant and we order a meal. It would be the difference between ordering a really well-balanced meal, so covering all of those categories within that food triangle we all know really well. So So like ordering a full turkey dinner versus someone going in ordering just a dessert. So we can see the difference between the two, and that also can be seen in these microbial foods as well. So not only looking at the mode of action, but which mode of actions within there are we selecting to feed our microbes. The next section would be your soil enzymes. So these promote specific reactions in the soil depending on which enzyme is applied. So an example of this would be something like a product that include a phosphatase, and a phosphatase would specifically help in liberating phosphorus within the soil. Then you have your category of your soil inoculants. So these are those products that contain those living bacteria and fungi. You're actually putting those microbes back into the soil. And depending on if you're putting a single or multiple species inoculant, it depends on the mode of action they have, because they're not all treated equally as well. So usually these are lumped into doing things such as mineralizing nutrients or promoting nutrient uptake into the plant. And then your fourth category would be your seaweed and kelp, or we can turn these sometimes as your macroalgae. So in general, those are used to help promote plant growth. They also play a role in plant defense responses, and they also play a role in reducing overall plant stressors. And the last one I want to cover is just your humic and fulvic acids. So these products can be derived from multiple sources. The most well-known would be your lignite or leonardite source, or also sometimes called brown coal. So humic acids play a role really in your soil structure and your nutrient retention, while the smaller molecules or the molecular weight are your fulvic acids, and those play more of a role in your nutrient chelation and also nutrient delivery.
Clearly, with carbon products alone, there are multiple modes of action to choose from, so how does a grower even go about doing that for their field or orchard? It starts with understanding the unique mode of action and what is trying to be achieved.
Really, to begin, you need to assess the field, the crop, and the operation that we're going into. And then from there, we can begin to select which carbon products or blends of products we need to start incorporating into our practices. So if you're kind of new into this carbon product field, I would suggest by starting taking a soil sample or looking at your previous soil samples you've taken in past years and really understanding, you know, what issues are you seeing in the field over time, and are you seeing anything related necessarily to nutrient deficiencies, issues with drought, and that can kind of start leading the way on which product is best suited for your growing practice. So really, once you've collected your overall data of how your crop's performing or your field's performing, that's a great time then to consult with an ag retailer, a CCA, or agronomist to really help collect the best product for your operation. And so an easy example I would say is if you're looking at your field history and you know you have a history of nutrient leaching or poor CEC, that's when we would start looking at something like maybe incorporating a humic into your soil application. If you're seeing something like you're having your poor soil structure or you really can't seem to withstand drought conditions very well during the season, then we might suggest adding some sort of microbial food source to help improve your soil microbiome. Of which we know that can help you withstand drought during those conditions. So, and I think another really important factor is to understand that we all know that we're usually not just faced with one issue in the field. We commonly see these issues compounding on one another. So for instance, when you see something like soil compaction, usually we also see poor water infiltration, and that can also have an effect on your microbial populations in your soil, which also can have an impact on your nutrient uptake. So we're seeing multiple different things happening within the field. So this is when we can leverage all the tools that we have in our tool belt and all these different carbon products and start to stack these carbon chemistries together to help us achieve our best results.
One other question, how does a grower know if these carbon products or other biological products are even working in the first place? Sometimes it's just as simple as an eye test. Other times, full lab tests are required. Millian said that growers that know their fields have an easier time distinguishing whether or not the products are working. Other times, it requires a closer look.
Setting up a really good testing method throughout the season, being consistent, so either if it's taking soil samples or tissue samples, and looking at your nutrient availability, that's one good place to start. So you can start really tracking that, not only from, you know, week to week, but also from year to year to see how we're improving throughout those years. There's also those other tests, like I mentioned before, that test soil health, and there's some soil carbon measurement tests as well. to help you quantify that in your field. And again, that will pair with which carbon input you're putting on which one to select. But if you're coming into adding a new product into your operation, I like to suggest let's not just go out there and take your full 1,000 acres and apply this new product across everything, because then we have nothing to compare it to, right? We can maybe compare it to last year if we took good detailed measurements, but I like to suggest running a test strip. So let's break that 1,000 acres down and let's only treat maybe 100 acres or a few hundred acres, so we can compare that to the rest of the field. Also, that's easier for you to keep a more detailed eye on that smaller section of your field rather than having to go through that full 1,000 acres on a weekly basis to understand really what's happening. And so I think really just sticking to that measuring consistent and often and knowing what your crop looks like is the best way to go there. Carbon product is not an easy thing to really wrap your head around, especially if you're new into the field. So there's some really great published resources on helping understand this carbon space a little bit better, and also the mode of action. So there's a great article called Making Sense of Your Biostimulants for Improving Soil Health on the Progressive Crop Consultant. And also, if you want to go back to the PhycoTerra website, there's a really great blog post on selecting the right carbon products for your field that can help you understand this a little bit better.
This is Taylor Charlstrom reporting for My Ag Life.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Take advantage of early bird pricing for only $175. Price goes up after July 31st. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
Senate Ag Chair Debbie Stabenow, Ranking Member John Bozeman, and Senators Cory Booker and John Thune have introduced legislation to reduce digital commodities. The Digital Commodities Consumer Protection Act of 2022 will give the Commodity Futures Trading Commission new tools and authority it needs to regulate digital commodities and safeguard customers and markets. 1 in 5 Americans have used or traded digital assets, but these markets lack the transparency and accountability they expect from the financial system, according to Stabenow. That puts Americans' hard-earned money at risk. The senators say digital assets and blockchain technology have already and will continue to change the way the global markets function. They point out that the fastest-growing industry is governed largely by a patchwork of state-level regulations. Bozeman says that's not an effective way to make sure the market's rules work for everyone. He says the bill gives CFTC exclusive jurisdiction over the digital commodities spot market. What producers and others may see in the way of drought conditions on the ground level may not necessarily reflect the numbers in the weekly U.S. Drought Monitor. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
Several have been following the weekly U.S. Drought Monitor quite closely over the past 2 years of prolonged drought in the West. As Brian Fuchs of the National Drought Mitigation Center points out, perceptions of conditions on the ground level may not match up to drought monitor data.
Sometimes, especially on the agricultural side, depending on management practices or some of the conditions that were in place prior to that heat and dryness setting in, how the soils are and things like that, or the progress that the crop is currently in, what stage of development is it in, they may start seeing some of these impacts more readily on the ground, even when some of the data are not really showing it yet.
He notes drought monitor condition categories usually only change one intensity level per week.
It's going to take several weeks of changes on the map to get to that D2 or D3 level.
Yet Fuchs recognizes flash drought conditions in recent weeks have resulted in rapid changes in condition categories over a one-month period. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Dairy Department sales climbed by double digits in supermarkets across the country. Supermarket News says dairy category sales totaled just under $5.1 billion for the month, 16% higher year over year. The International Dairy Deli Bakery Association says in its June marketplace update that unit sales did drop 2.4% from last year. The IDDBA report says the consistency of the weekly sales levels, all at least $1.2 billion, is encouraging because it means demand is holding strong, especially compared to pre-COVID pre-COVID levels. The biggest sales took place in a week leading up to Father's Day, with total sales of $1.3 billion. Milk was easily the biggest seller in June at $1.3 billion, according to the report. The next biggest sellers were natural cheese and eggs, which moved ahead of yogurt because of high inflation. The average price per unit for eggs increased to $4.10, over 51% higher than June of 2021. A lack of rice could be the next big strain on a global food supply. Bloomberg News says a challenge may come from a lack of rain in parts of India, which is by far the biggest rice exporter in the world. The drier weather has caused India's rice planting area to contract to its smallest level in 3 years. The threat to India's rice production comes when countries across the world are struggling with the soaring cost of food and runaway inflation. The world's total planted area for rice has dropped by 13% this season because of a lack of rainfall. Traders fear diminished rice production will hurt India's battle with inflation and trigger export restrictions. Billions of people around the world would depend on rice, and India accounts for 40% of the world's rice trade. India's government has already curbed exports of wheat and sugar to safeguard their food supply. There is a lot of debate throughout the U.S. about whether the country is in a recession. Last week, a report showed the GDP dropped another 0.9 percentage point in a second quarter this year. It's a second straight quarter showing a drop in GDP, and many economists say it's a sign of a possible recession. The Federal Reserve also hiked the interest rate another 75 basis points. Jared Bernstein of the White House Council of Economic Advisors says the U.S. economy is going through a transition.
Well, there's no question that the economy is transitioning from the breakneck growth pace of 2021, when we more than replaced all the private sector jobs that were lost in the pandemic-induced recession. That was back before we got here. I think the president's plan when he arrived back in 2021 to get shots in arms and checks in pockets really set up that very strong growth rate that gave us the labor market backdrop that we're still enjoying today. But at the same time, we know that households are facing unacceptably high inflation.
The administration is happy to see gas prices lowering recently, but he also says there's more to do.
We're glad to see prices at the pump down a bit, about 74 cents or so nationwide, but that's not enough. More needs to be done. And that's why we're also glad to see the legislative agenda that's evolved over the past few days, including this Inflation Reduction Act that Democrats hope to pass through reconciliation. So there are a lot of moving parts, but I think when you get right down to how are households experiencing this economy, put aside, and do it quickly in my view, all of the technical definitions of this versus that variable, and ask the question, how are the American households doing?
While inflation is still too high, Bernstein says there is some good economic news out there.
The answer is that they face unacceptably high inflation, and it's a real stressor for them. We're doing everything we can to help. But the answer is also that they are living amidst one of the strongest job markets in our history, and that's a buffer that we shouldn't leave out of the conversation.
Is the U.S. in a recession?
If you look at the factors that determine a recession, I think the answer is unlikely. Now, we don't know this because the people who make this decision, they're called the National Bureau of Economic Research up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They look at consumer spending. That's up 1%. So this report, as you correctly identified, for the second quarter of the year, GDP was down 0.9, but consumer spending was up 1%. That's one of the key variables they look at. The other key variable they look at is payroll job growth. That's also up.
Jared Bernstein of the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
My AgLife Daily News reporter Kylie Harlan is in next. She talks about a parasitic wasp that controls a highly destructive fruit fly that's being released after 12 years of research.
Researchers at Oregon State University are preparing to release a parasitic wasp to help manage a highly destructive fruit fly. Vaughn Walton, a professor at Oregon State University, has been working on this project and brings us more details.
If we look at Drosophila suzukii, about 12, 13 years ago, it first was found here on the West Coast. So it was found first in 2008 in California, then it was found the following year in Oregon and up into British Columbia directly after that within the same year. And so the parasitoid itself is or has been collected in South Korea, China, as well as Japan. And that work started about 10 years ago, more or less. And it had gone through the process of importation. We needed importation permits. The bug was, or several species of parasitoids were imported. Some of the technicians in my lab, of which the maybe the most instrumental person was Betsy Miller, had worked with scientists down at the UC Berkeley, Dr. Kent Dane, and worked towards bringing the parasitoids in. They were tested under quarantine, very detailed testing to see if they're efficient parasitoids. Are they specific in terms of attacking Drosophila suzukii? We went through multiple experiments to determine whether they're suitable or not. Went through, I think, two rounds of applications through the USDA, APHIS, and finally got an approval last year to start the release process.
The fruit fly, commonly known as spotted wing Drosophila, causes great damage to fruit crops around the country. The economic loss caused by this pest is estimated to be very high. Walton tells us more about how and why this fruit fly is devastating to the agriculture industry.
Drosophila suzukii, or spotted wing Drosophila, is very damaging. During the first year in Oregon, growers were talking about losing half of their crop. The previous year in California, they had lost a lot of their crop in cherries, and some growers were actually going out of business, or were thinking that they'd be going out of business, because this pest is really devastating. Things have changed. We're 12 years later or so, and at the moment, our best estimate is that growers are losing approximately 10% of their crop because of spotted wing Drosophila when they're managing it. And so if we're looking at an Oregon blueberry industry as an example, depending on the value of the industry, but if we say that the industry is a $140 million farm gate industry, you're losing about $14 million direct farm gate value for that crop. That excludes the management costs. It excludes the fruit that's dropping onto the ground when you're spraying pesticides, things like that. And so pretty significant value when you're looking at the respective industries. Some estimates say that we're losing about $500 million per year because of this crop, because of this insect pest. And so, pretty substantial quantity of money. In the early days, we were estimating losing about half a billion or $500 million on the West Coast alone. But it's improved a little bit since our methods of control have definitely improved as well.
To suppress the populations of spotted wing Drosophila, researchers will soon release a beneficial wasp. Walton tells us more about the release process.
So when we think of releases of wasps, we think of it as releasing the wasp in the crop like we would spray a pesticide, right? And so that is actually something that we need to talk about a little bit, because it's done in a slightly different way. We know through our scientific studies that I'd say about 90% of all spotted wing Drosophila is found outside of the crop. It's not in the crop. And so when we're doing our releases of our parasitoids, we release our parasitoids in these areas around the crop. The reason for that is that we know that we have spotted wing Drosophila in those surrounding non-crop hosts. And so when you're releasing those parasitoids, you know that there is something that they can go and parasitize. You know they can go and attack those. The climate in the surrounding vegetation is much more moderate as well. When you're looking at blueberry or blackberry or raspberry, you've got direct sunlight shining on that. When you're releasing a parasitoid, these are tiny little things. You want to be releasing them in the most optimal environment. That is where we find the surrounding vegetation. So the work that people have done in the lab have shown that these parasitoids are what we call density dependent. So as your pest insect increases, so too does your parasitoid populations increase. And so within a few months after your initial release, you will expect these parasitoids to increase to such an extent that it starts suppressing those populations in the surrounding vegetation. And that is where the benefit comes from. It's not necessarily in the crop, but it's in the surrounding vegetation. Those flies from the surrounding vegetation, if they're not parasitized, they will come into the crop and cause damage there. But if those populations are suppressed at lower population levels, they're not going to be attacking the crop. So this means your crop is not at the same risk anymore. This means that instead of spraying 5 times per season, maybe you're spraying 2 times per season. And so, it's becoming less and less expensive. We're not using as much pesticides anymore to control the pest. And under ideal conditions, those parasitoid numbers will keep the pest numbers at such a level that hopefully we'll never have to spray pesticides anymore. Whether that's going to happen is still need to be determined. We don't have a clear picture on that.
This parasitic wasp has been referred to as a specialist, meaning it prefers to feed on spotted-winged Drosophila compared to other insects. Researchers are confident this specialty wasp will not become an invasive pest problem.
People sometimes ask this question. They'll say, oh, if spotted-winged Drosophila goes away, will this bug come and attack us and sting us and that kind of stuff? These are tiny little things. They're like 0.5 millimeter in length, 1/16 of an inch, maybe even less than that, a 32nd of an inch in length, tiny little things. So firstly, we don't have to worry about them attacking us as human beings. But, you know, we've seen other scenarios where people have done importation of natural enemies. And as I said earlier, we did a lot of testing to determine, are these natural enemies specific? Do they only attack spotted-winged Drosophila, or will they go and attack other organisms as well? This parasitoid only attacks spotted-winged Drosophila, preferentially attacks spotted-winged Drosophila. So when spotted-winged Drosophila goes away, these parasitoid populations are tightly linked to those pest insect numbers. You have these other scenarios. The classic example, I think that one of the journalists love citing is the cane toad example. You know, you bring a cane toad in, and a cane toad doesn't only eat the beetles that it was brought in to eat. It's eating 50 other things as well. And now suddenly it becomes a problem because it eats all these other, maybe sometimes good bugs as well. We don't want that. We want something that only attacks that one insect. It's like a pesticide. You know, you spray pesticide, kills everything. We want something that has only an impact on that pest insect. And that's what we were able to do with this parasitoid.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.